The Distinguishing Characteristic of a Christian, Part 1, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 8, 2019, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A handout titled "The Distinguishing Characteristic of a Christian" accompanies this talk.
Okay, we finished our study of Galatians. I would like to kind of park on one of the things that we talked about last week and use that as a springboard for kind of a one-time topical thing that I want to do today. Reading from my translation, if you'll remember, he said, I have to find it. "Now the one who is being taught an account of the gospel that consists in all good things is to hold it in common with the one who teaches it. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Indeed, whatever a man sows, this he will in fact reap. For the one who sows for his own sarks, his flesh, will by reason of his flesh reap destruction. But the one who sows for the Spirit will by reason of his Spirit reap ionic life." The whole history of Christianity really basically is summed up in people not paying attention to what Paul was warning about there, what he was exhorting us to do there. As I suggested last week, I think the point that he's making is when it comes to deciding what it is you're going to believe, what it is you're going to embrace, what it is you're going to make your own from that which is being taught to you, we're going to decide on the basis of one of two things. Either what it is that the Spirit of God is counseling us to embrace, the truth that the Spirit of God is encouraging us to embrace, or that which we, out of the sinful, rebellious, evil, wicked, self-serving desires of my very being, what I want to be true, what is gratifying to me somehow, what appeals to me at some level. And I'm going to go in one of two directions, and what Paul was warning them there is don't sow for the purposes of gratifying your flesh, your evil, sinful humanity, but sow for following the counsel of the Spirit of God. But what's happened over the years, of course, is that Christians, one generation after the next generation after the next generation, have sowed to the flesh and not to the Spirit. And so we end up at a time in history where we don't have Christianity, we have Christianities. There must be 50 ways to be a Christian, or more. And depending upon which worldview you embrace, which set of values you embrace, which set of practices you embrace, they all go by the name of Christianity, but they can be worlds apart. There can be Christians who have more in common with a Buddhist monk than they do with Jesus and his disciples. Or Christians who have more in common with, I won't even try to pronounce the Sanskrit word, but a certain kind of Hindu than they do with Jesus and the disciples. But hopefully, we're not interested in being Christians. Hopefully, what we're interested in is the truth that was actually taught to us by Jesus, and that we want to be counted among the number of those people who believe what Jesus taught, and we are following the Jesus of history, not the Jesus of our imagination, not the Jesus that our flesh would be gratified to believe in, but the Jesus that was actually sent by God into the world to reveal the truth. Years ago, many years ago, I was on a radio program here in Eugene, and it was a talk show. George, some of you know him. he was the host, and we had some callers calling in, and the issue was the issue of Sabbath keeping. And a Seventh-day Adventist called in, and he was insisting on how important it was to keep the Sabbath. And there was a back and forth, and we each had our arguments, but I will never forget the final comment that he made. He said, "Well, if we don't keep the Sabbath, how are we as Christians different than anybody else in the world?" And it was incredibly telling. I mean, it was an incredibly important insight into his mindset, into the mindset of this person, because from his perspective, the most distinguishing mark of being a follower of Jesus is that you keep the Sabbath. And if you don't have that, what have you got? How are you really any different than anybody else? So what I would like to do today is go through, I'd like to address the question, what is the distinguishing characteristic of a Christian? And when I say Christian in this context, I mean, what's the distinguishing characteristic of a true child of God who is a bona fide follower of the real Jesus, who therefore is going to inherit eternal life one day? What is it that is the distinguishing characteristic of such a person? Now, the title's ambiguous because all of those different Christianities are going to have their own answer to that question. And all of them follow a very, very different path and have a very different template that they try to conform to. So I'm going to, first of all, look at all the ways that we have given wrong answers to that question or misguided, wrong-headed answers to that question, and I will finally end up by suggesting what I think the right answer is, the biblical answer is. Okay. If you're following on my outline, I will read this because you may not all have the outline that got sent to you, but I want to read it and then comment on it. So I begin with answers that are just fundamentally wrong-headed and are entirely and completely false. They don't even come close to embracing the worldview that we get by reading the Bible. The first one is that the follower of Jesus is one who seeks to control his life, circumstances, and environment through God-ordained practices, and I would say superstitions, because that's what they are. But from the perspective of these Christians, God has given to us various practices, various techniques, various devices that we can use to make our life go better. We can prosper. We can be kept safe. We can be protected from harm. Our marriages will go better, our parenting will go better, our business will go better, our emotional landscape will be better, we'll be happier people. All of these things can be controlled if we simply use those tools that God gave us. Prayer, fasting, maybe Bible study or church attendance, meditation, any number of things that are proposed and used. And the idea is, why do I pray? Why do I fast? Why do I do what I'm doing? I'm doing what I'm doing because I want to prevent harm from coming into my life. Or I want to promote prosperity and wealth and happiness and whatever. Hopefully you can recognize how fundamentally pagan that is. That's exactly what paganism consists of. I mean, what pagan in the world does not do what they do to use whatever magic has been placed into their hands, whatever religious devices have been put into their hands? Why are they doing it? Because they want the powers that be to be focused on solving their problems in life. They want to be healthy, they want to be wealthy, they want to be prosperous, they want protection from harm, and so they do what they believe that they're supposed to do to make all that stuff happen. Just take those devices and turn them into Christian tools, and you've got a whole stream of Christianity that is really paganism, but it goes by the name of Christianity, where we are encouraged to use all these religious practices and devices to control our life. I just cringe every time I'm behind a car with the bumper sticker, "Prayer changes things." Now, I know those are Christians, but prayer changes things? That is about as pagan a mentality as you can get. It's God who changes things. It's not my using the devices that he's given to me to focus his power and his energy and his will on solving my problem and changing my life. I'm not in control. God is in control. And any spiritual practice that I engage in has to be about me conforming to his will, not getting God to conform to my will. That's fundamentally and essentially pagan. I was in a conversation years and years and years ago with someone very dear to me who went to a church on the East Coast that had this doctrine, this peculiar doctrine, that if you had enough faith, you would not die. If you had enough faith, your life would, you'd keep all kinds of evils away from you, and if you had enough faith, if it was pure enough and perfect enough, you wouldn't even die. And lo and behold, the woman in the church who had the purest faith of all died. Now, how do we handle things like that? I think we ought to reconsider whether or not we're thinking about things straight. But as this person did, and is typical of most of us, wow, I guess she didn't have as much faith as I thought she should have, or as I thought she had. We make our perception of the reality fit our doctrine rather than be willing to reconsider our doctrine. And as I talked further with this man, I was astonished when again the conversation ended. Well, if believing in Jesus doesn't keep you healthy and prevent you from dying, then what good is he? Now, he was just being honest about a mindset and a perspective that I think hundreds of and thousands of Christians have. He was just being a little bit more honest, I think, about it. But that's the perspective that sees who is the Christian. It's the one who's using prayer and fasting and Bible study and all of these things in their life to somehow change their circumstances and change their life so that it will go better. Well, I'm arguing that that's fundamentally false. The next one that is wrongheaded and false: the follower of Jesus is one who practices various spiritual disciplines in order to bring about his own spiritual formation. Now, I'm using that phrase not because I understand what spiritual formation is, but because that's the term that typically gets used. There are whole departments, at least there were a few years ago, I'm not like in touch any longer, but it may still be true, that you can go to seminaries and major in spiritual formation. There are whole departments set aside to spiritual formation. So this is a big deal in certain segments of Christianity, or has been in recent years. Spiritual formation is using the spiritual disciplines, prayer, fasting, meditation, voluntary poverty, Bible study, journaling, then probably you can add to the list, but there are various things that we are encouraged to do because the claim is those things are going to alter my attitudes, my desires, my character, my mindset, in order to lead to me becoming either more godly or more spiritual or more righteous perhaps, or in any case, stronger in faith. And so I promote my faith and character and attitude, desires and attitudes, I change them by using these practices. These practices go to work on me and change me. You might know years ago, Richard Foster wrote a book. I can't remember the name of it. And Dallas Willard is another very well-known Christian who has written a number of books where he's advancing this kind of perspective and encouraging us to practice spiritual formation by using religious practices. Well, if you have this mindset, then that's going to rise to the forefront. How do you know who is a Christian? Or they're the people whose life is just absolutely saturated with the use of the spiritual disciplines. They pray and they fast and they meditate and they do this, that, and the other thing, and their whole life is devoted and committed to transforming themselves through one set of spiritual practices, spiritual disciplines, or another. This is very attractive to our flesh. It's very attractive to the sinner in me. Because notice what it's doing. It's saying that I can substitute something very doable for something that is impossible and not doable at all. And what do I mean by that? What am I really faced with in this life? As in following Jesus, I come across many, many choices in my life where I need to choose to do what is righteous, to do what is good, to do what is obedient to God. And being the person that I am, I don't want to be obedient to God. I don't want to be good. I don't want to do the things that Jesus would have me to do. And in fact, I come across areas of my life where it's impossible to do them. All I can do is flat fall on my face and say, God, save me. God, deliver me from me. Save me from me. I am not the kind of person that I know I need to be. And we get frustrated with the seeming powerlessness that I experience in the face of the demands of God. Well, what if we could make it easier? What if, instead of actually having to make the choice that I can't seem to actually make, what if I could do this other thing that somehow magically makes that other choice possible for me? I will be able to avoid temptation if I just spend a little time praying or in Bible study or fasting or meditating or this, that, or the other thing. That's the promise. You know, that's the claim that's being made, is that this other stuff that you can't do is going to become doable if you will just do these things that like anybody could do, if they want to, if they're motivated enough. I mean, do you need the Spirit of God to not eat? Well, that's a bad example, yeah. Do you need the Spirit of God to take out your Bible and read it for a little while? No, that's doable. Any Hell's Angel could do that. So if the claim is that by doing that, all this other problem of powerlessness in the face of goodness and righteousness and obedience, the experience, is going to just evaporate for you, who wouldn't be attracted to that? Of course that would be desirable. But it's a huge distraction. And it's completely and entirely beside the point. It's not what our life is all about. Third one. The follower of Jesus is one who lives a life in pursuit of ecstatic experiences produced by God. In the modern times, the pursuit of speaking in tongues is the most common, the most typical modern example of this. But it's ancient. You have it right there in the book of 1 Corinthians itself, where many of them were pursuing this ecstatic experience where they felt like they were being taken over by a god, in this case, by the Spirit of God. And Paul points out to them, that's what you were doing as pagans, right? Wasn't Bacchus taking control of you when you went to a bacchanalia and got yourself drunk and whipped into a frenzy, and all of a sudden you lost control and you interpreted that as the god Bacchus taking over, or Dionysius, or some other wild and crazy god that took over? That's what you did as a pagan. We don't do that as Christians. That's not what this is all about. The Spirit of God doesn't take control of your life and you stop being a human being. The Spirit of God counsels you and tutors you and encourages you toward the truth, but you choose it and you understand it with your mind and you embrace it with your heart and your will. You don't lose control. And there's no ecstatic experience that is the experience of the Spirit of God. The experience of the Spirit of God is very quiet and very ordinary. And he says in that chapter in 1 Corinthians 13, what is it that characterizes the activity and power and effect of the Spirit of God? You say, Jesus Christ is Lord. And mean it. That you from your heart, you embrace the idea that Jesus is your Messiah and Lord. If you can do that, then the Spirit of God is transforming your life. Okay. But how many millions of Christians in the world today, if you were to ask them how they knew they were Christians, they would point to their experience of speaking in glossolalia and say, because I have this weird religious phenomenon happening to me, that's how I know that I'm a Christian, because that's the most important and most distinctive thing about being a Christian. Never mind that glossolalia occurs in every world religion and in witchcraft and in any number of other things. It's commonplace across the world. But by calling it speaking in tongues and pointing to a verse in the Bible, we say, no, this is the apex of spirituality, and that's how I know I'm a Christian. The follower of Jesus is one who seeks to live a life punctuated by altered states of consciousness. Consciousness-altering meditation or contemplation and emotion-altering worship are two important examples, probably the most important examples, of the practices employed to bring about an altered state of consciousness. Now, by an altered state of consciousness, I mean, hopefully you know what I mean, but I'm not talking about the stuff that drugs do to you. That is also an altered state of consciousness. But I can alter my state of consciousness right now. I mean, we could do this. I could say take 15 seconds and feel deeply adoration for Jesus. Let's adore him together. Now, I'm not a good enough actor, but is not every worship leader in the nation across the world, don't they invite you to alter your own consciousness, to manufacture a kind of feeling, to mess with your head inside so that you feel love or adoration or gratitude or praise or this, that, or the other thing? Let's alter our state of consciousness and focus on on our relationship with God in a particular kind of way. And we do it every week, week after week after week after week. And we go away feeling like we have been, what's the word we use? Recharged, right? I have been recharged. I went to that worship service and I couldn't live without it because I go every week and I get recharged. Well, of course you did. But to what end? To what effect? Is your life any different? Are you any different? Have you been actually transformed? Or did you just mess with your head for a little while and get some escape and some relief, some rest of some kind? We can do that. It's a very human thing to do. You wouldn't have to be a Christian to do that. Any atheist could do the same thing. How many churches will tell you that the whole point of our existence is worship? That's why we're here, to worship God. But interestingly, what they mean by that, on the one hand, they'll say, because we're giving God the praise that is his due. Well, God is due that praise, and that's a good thing, to give God the praise that he's due. But we're doing more than giving God the praise that he's due. We're altering our state of consciousness so that we think that we are grateful, so that we feel like we adore him. We feel like we are honoring him. But honor doesn't come by feeling like you honor him. Honor comes by giving him your life to honor him in the way that you live your life. And that's an entirely different matter, an entirely different thing. Music, of course, is very helpful in worship. That's why music has become such a big deal in Christian culture. It probably always has been. And again, music is a very, very human phenomenon. We love music. It can inspire us. I've told this story to some of you before, but the most worshipful experience in my entire life was at the Circle Star Theater in Redwood City, listening to Peter, Paul, and Mary. Because the acoustics were phenomenal. They were tight. It was a great concert. And I just got this incredible feeling, I want to be a good person. I want to be a good person. Well, it's easy to have that feeling and to walk out of a concert or a worship service, which effectively is a concert often, to walk out of there being affected in that particular kind of way. And nothing wrong with that. But let's not think that's what our faith is all about. Occasionally, in the midst of that kind of feeling, I might actually make an existential commitment. I'm going to define that in a second. But I might actually make an inward, personal, existential commitment that literally is life-changing. It literally is life-transforming. That can happen. But it didn't happen because of the music. What happened because of the music was how I felt. The existential decision gets made at a deeper level than that. And just because we might find it coincident with the feeling doesn't mean that the feeling was the work of the Spirit of God, or that we should always use music to try to promote spirituality in people, because look what happened to me. There was no music, to my knowledge, when Paul's life was turned around. It was a bright light and blindness is what turned his life around. In all of our lives, we all have different stories. We all have different circumstances that surrounded me coming to make an existential decision. I flunked a physics exam. It was the most important thing that ever happened to me, and it changed my life. wasn't anything fun about it. But can somebody be inspired by music to a certain feeling, and in the midst of that feeling, actually, because of other things that have been going on in their life, decide, I want my life to be defined by my relationship with Jesus? Sure. Absolutely. But it's the existential commitment that defines me as a believer, not the music, not the worship, not the feeling. Now, I might use existential commitment here a number of times, so let me define it. And the reason I feel the need to define it is because the word existential, I understand, has been picked as word of the year by some dictionary, as in existential crisis. When the journalists use it over and over and over and over again these days, they are not using it the way Kierkegaard used it, the way I prefer to use it, the way it's meaningful in the context of Christianity. An existential crisis is a crisis where if things don't work out right, your very existence is going to be jeopardized, or the very existence of an institution or of a country or of a people or something. So they're talking about the existence of something being threatened in an existential crisis. When I talk about an existential commitment, I mean it the way Kierkegaard used it. He's using the word existence to stand for a particular individual's human existence. Your particular existence is existence, as far as he's concerned. You know, you're not like a rock or a tree or something else that is. You're not just sitting there being. You are existing. You have existence. Well, and the question for someone like Kierkegaard is, we all have to face the question, what am I going to do with my existence, my particular individual life and existence? What am I going to do with it? Am I going to define it this way? Am I going to define it by these choices, by these commitments, by these desires, by fulfilling these desires, or something else? And one thing that we learn from Kierkegaard is that the very nature of the biblical faith is that we are, each and every human being is called upon to make an existential choice, that is, a choice that is going to define his existence, to pursue God, the infinite, Jesus, his son, and whatever. Or we can define our existence by something else. We'd be fools to do that, but we can do that. So an existential choice. When I got up this morning and decided to wear dark socks instead of white socks, that was a choice, but it was not an existential choice. It used to be when I was younger, but not this morning. Because I'm not defining my very existence by that choice. It doesn't matter that much to me. But when I decide whether or not I'm going to make Jesus my Lord, that's an existential choice that I'm making. I'm deciding that my very being and my very existence is going to be defined by my relationship to Jesus. And that's faith. Okay. It doesn't do any good to feel like I want my whole life to be defined by my relationship with Jesus if I don't do it. If I don't act like I want my whole life to be defined by my relationship with Jesus. Feeling that I want to do that for a moment, for a while, temporarily, is just a feeling. Might be a good feeling, but it's just a feeling. Okay. Again, you see why it's attractive to my humanity to make that substitution again. The feeling is more doable. It's easier to come by. Actually making the existential commitment, that's a tough one. You know, there's that famous thing that Kierkegaard said, when Lessing said there's this big ditch between me and Christianity and belief in Christianity. There's this big ditch. And if somebody would come and bridge the gap, I'd love to be a Christian. I'd be delighted to be a Christian. But there's this big ditch there of lack of evidence, of insufficient proof that Christianity is true. And I need somebody to give me the evidence and the proof that it's true. And then I'd be gladly march right over there into Christianity and be a Christian. And Kierkegaard famously said, every ditch is infinitely broad to the person who doesn't want to jump. And that is the problem that each and every one of us face. Do I really want to make the decision that my whole cotton-picking life is going to be defined by my relationship to this dude, Jesus? Am I really going to do that? Am I really willing to do that? And the answer for almost all of mankind is no way. I can't do that. It's too risky. It's too scary. It's too dumb. It's too weird. It's too corny. We have all kinds of excuses, but no way in the world am I going to do that. I can't do that. And it's only by the miracle performed by God in my life that he brings me to a point where I go, I don't have any other choice. It doesn't make any sense to define my existence by anything other than my relationship with Jesus. So I guess I got to do that. And it's by the Spirit of God that miraculously my heart gets moved to the point where I'm willing to make that decision, make that choice. But wouldn't it be easier if we could just feel like we wanted to make that decision and not ever actually make the decision? That's more attractive to us in our rebellion, in our sarks, our flesh. Okay, the next one, 1.5. The follower of Jesus is one who seeks to live his life in nearness to God. I remember when I was a young Christian, teenager, I think, I read a book by Brother Lawrence called Practicing the Presence of God. And it was not at all uncommon for people around me to suggest that this is what it was all about. This was what we really needed to do, is to be able to go through every ordinary day, moment by moment, not having a moment go by where I didn't feel God's presence. I didn't feel near to him. And we had a whole doctrine that was based on how near to God you felt. You were either in fellowship or out of fellowship with God. And what did it mean to be out of fellowship with God? Well, he seemed a long ways away. And if God seemed a long ways away, I guess you were out of fellowship with God, because if you were in fellowship with God, he's right there. And you'd feel him being near and you'd feel him being present. And then, of course, how do you get near to him? Well, spiritual discipline, spiritual practices, prayer, Bible study, quiet time, that kind of thing. But that's what makes a Christian a Christian. A Christian is somebody who always feels the presence of God and always feels near to God. But again, like all these other feelings we've been talking about, we could manufacture that if we wanted to. I dare say if you put your mind to it, you could feel the presence of God right now. Make yourself feel it. You'd manufacture it. You'd make it up. Is God any more near than he was before you felt it? No, of course not. But you feel like he is because you made it happen. That's not what our faith is all about. That's not what it means to be a Christian. Okay, then there are other answers that can be given that mistake non-essential pursuits and take them to be the core distinctive pursuit of the Jesus follower. Now, this whole list that follows now, these are things that are valid. There's nothing invalid or illegitimate about them. But they are not essential. And what I mean by that is a genuine bona fide believer could go his or her whole life and never engage in the practices that follow here that I'm about to talk about. They don't have to do them. It's not what it means to be a Christian, but are they things that could be helpful and might make sense and might be meaningful? Sure. Yeah, they might be. But the mistake we make is that we take these things that aren't even essential, as valid as they might be, they're not even essential, and we make them the core distinctive attribute of somebody who follows Jesus, who believes in Jesus. So all of these fit into that category. First one, the follower of Jesus is one who seeks to correct social injustice. For some Christians, the essence of their faith is to champion the fight against some form of social injustice. I'm jumping down to B here for a second. While some individuals may be called by God to devote their lives to a specific fight against a certain social injustice, for example, the slave trade, I don't know. I wasn't old enough to know William Wilberforce. I'm not old enough to have known William Wilberforce. But it's entirely possible that William Wilberforce was genuinely called by God. This was not some kind of counterfeit religious effort on his part, but was perfectly legitimate obedience to his Lord. Let me assume that. I have no reason to not assume that. So God had simply called him to work against the slave trade in England, and much of his life was devoted to that. So some individuals may be called by God to some or another fight against some grievous social injustice in the world. But it most certainly is not the center and essence of what being a follower of Jesus is all about. To maintain that it is manifests a deep ignorance of the teaching of the Bible. And yet, you'll have people defend this perspective over and over and over again, as if, well, of course, Jesus taught us to love people. Therefore, because Jesus taught us to love people, if you don't jump on board with my cause against this social injustice and help me with that, then I doubt if you're even really a Christian. You've probably confronted that. I have, where you, if not said out and out in that way, you certainly are left with the impression that there's something very illegitimate about your discipleship, your following Jesus, if you don't devote the same energy and the same passion against fighting this social injustice that I am. Somebody who actually has been called by God to that end is going to understand that my passion may not be your passion. My cause may not be your cause. My efforts need not be your efforts. You need to follow your Lord, not me. And as Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, the hand should not be saying to the foot, I have no need of you. One part of the body shouldn't be saying to another part of the body, because you're not me, I doubt if you're even a believer. Because you're not marching to the same beat of the drum that I am, then I have to question whether you're even a believer or not. Well, I will understand that I can't judge you by me if I am simply doing what God has called me to do. But the minute I cross the line and I make what God has called me to do to be the distinctive characteristic of everyone who claims to be a believer, then I'm no longer thinking the way the Bible is thinking. I'm no longer looking at the faith the way the Bible teaches the faith. It's becoming increasingly common, I think, to make the mistake that a follower of Jesus is one who seeks to correct social injustice. And the pressure of that is coming from the orthodox religion of wider American culture, what I call postmodern secular progressivism, because that's what that is all about. Correcting social injustices is the righteousness of the PSP religion. And that is affecting all of us and putting pressure on all of us. So more and more you're seeing Christians capitulate to that. And they're thinking that that's what we have to be all about, that only better. You know, we need to do a better job of confronting social injustice in the world. No, we don't. Jesus left with a whole lot of social injustice still in the world when he departed. Okay, moving on to the next point. The follower of Jesus is one who champions orthodox doctrines and beliefs and repudiates unorthodox doctrines and beliefs. From the perspective of New Testament teaching, a right understanding of truth is clearly important and much to be desired, obviously. However, the belief of the Jesus follower is clearly expected to be much more than a mere intellectual understanding of what is accurate and true. Without an inward existential commitment to live one's life in the light of the truth, a mere intellectual grasp of the truth is of no real value, no matter how accurate it is. But those, in our experience, those who most energetically insist on doctrinal orthodoxy typically conceive of faith as mere intellectual understanding and confession, and they give little, if any, emphasis to inward existential commitment. Now, I know this mistake well because I've spent most of my life making this mistake, I think. I grew up in churches where this just got reinforced, that the most important thing, you know, why was the church that I was going to, why were we all going to go to heaven and all going to be saved and all of us are authentic bona fide Christians, and all those Catholics and Episcopalians and Lutherans and Presbyterians, they're really out of it and God's really going to have be merciful to them to allow them in. Why did I know that we were in, me and my church? Because we had the right beliefs. We had the right doctrines. We were completely biblical, completely orthodox through and through. And so, of course, we were the good guys. So that's been my mentality most of my life. I mean, interestingly, I didn't get that from my parents. I just got it from the churches that they drug me to. But they didn't really take that perspective. So it is not uncommon for a Christian to adopt the mindset that because he champions a truly biblical doctrinal system, he is most certainly righteous and acceptable in the eyes of God. That's what I thought. I've been on the internet a little bit here recently, and there seems to be a resurgence of heretic hunting. I don't know if you've noticed, but boy, are they're making a whole industry out of it. There are whole blogs and websites and everything devoted to taking a look out there. What are the preachers saying? What are the Bible teachers saying? Oh, I think you crossed the line into heresy. I think you're not being orthodox here. And again, all of the discussion around it has absolutely nothing to do with the inner existential commitments of the person that they're critiquing, that they're looking at. And yet that's the only thing that counts. I mean, there's not a single one of us who is going to get 100% on the theology quiz that we take when we go into the pearly gates. You know, we're all going to get get some things wrong, but what we're all going to have in common is that my heart is committed to knowing, honoring, obeying, and following Jesus. That's what we will have in common. There's going to be a lot of differences in us about how all this works and what God is doing and what the truth is about God and his promises and his purposes and how you put it all together. We still have a whole lot of thinking to do before we get that right. And none of us have it right. So we're making a lot of mistakes in our theology and in our doctrine. None of us are truly orthodox in that sense. But we do have an orthos cardia, a straight heart, a right heart. And that's the basis upon which we are going to be received. Again, years ago, there was a student at Gutenberg who knew not only what the doctrine was, but he knew exactly which creed signed in which year was the absolute truth about what the Bible taught. And if I didn't wholeheartedly, what's the word I'm looking for?
Endorse,
thank you. If I did not endorse that creed in its entirety, then there was something wrong with me. And he finally left the college because of me. He couldn't take me any longer. And at the time, I had a class entitled In Search of Truth, not a class, a radio program. Ron and I were doing a radio program with Tony Arlen called In Search of Truth. And as he's walking out the door, he's saying to me, I don't want to go to some place where they're still looking for truth. I want to go someplace where they've already found it. And it wouldn't really matter to someone in the mindset that he was in. It wouldn't really matter what drove the individual, what their heart commitments were, what their existential commitments were. It was all on the outside, all on the externality. What beliefs do you endorse? If you endorse these beliefs, great. If you don't endorse these beliefs, then you are evil and you are a heretic. Some of the most evil people in the world that I've ever met have been utterly insistent on orthodoxy. Because their orthodoxy is out here. But if you look into their insides, into their heart, what's the word Jesus would use? They are whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones. Now, on the inside, there's nothing but death. But let's polish our orthodox exterior and make sure that we are endorsing the right things. Is this worth 2 weeks on? Okay, let me pause here then for questions, and we'll finish this next week.
This is the sort of question that I'd actually like, I'm not even sure I want you to answer it now. Kind of the sort of thing that I'd like to hear your thoughts on. And I'm going to be up front here. I've had a little trouble at times sorting out two strains in your teaching. Mm-hmm. And one of them is this strain, which I thought was really great, and I followed it. I really liked it. And then there's this other strain that is kind of about how important it is. I mean, what it sounds to me at times is you're saying that it's really important that we get it right. And I'm not sure, I'm being totally upfront, I'm not sure that I can put together in my mind how you put it together when mm-hmm. you're talking about that stuff. So I think it's an important question, and I'm really not challenging anything here, but I'm just, sometimes there are things that you said that sound like they're sort of in a different vein than the sort of thing that you said now.
Okay.
So do you know the kind of thing I'm talking about? Especially like the thing that you did on 1 Corinthians, you said that it had really kind of brought you up short about how important it was that we not just have the basics right, but that we have all the implications of the gospel right.
And right.
It was
1
really
Corinthians
important
3,
that we got
yeah.
those. So that's kind of the thing that I'm trying to put together in your message here is how those things go together.
Okay.
But maybe now's not the time to answer that question.
Yeah, let me start next week. answering that question or giving some thoughts on that question.
Great.
Jack, for those of us who aren't going to be here next week, do you mind giving a quick synopsis of what you think is characteristic of the authentic follower?
Okay, well, it's very, very simply there. I listed, I think, four things. It can be reduced to one thing. It's what the Bible calls holiness. The one thing that's distinctive that and is unique to believers, unique to Christians, is their holiness. Now, the problem with that is that means nothing to most of us because it needs to be defined. I divided that into five things, I think. The one who pursues holiness is going to seek to know and understand the truth, will seek to take the reality of God into account in everything he thinks, does, and desires. He will seek to love others, and he will seek to pursue righteousness, purity, and goodness. And those four things, I will argue, those are not unique to followers of Jesus. I think you would find those are true of Enoch in days of old, Noah, Abraham, Moses. So long before Jesus is even in the picture, you have those four things. Did I list four? Those four things would characterize someone who God is choosing for himself and sanctifying, making holy, setting apart, making weird and different in this world, to mark him as someone who belonged to him and was going to be a part of the eternal people of God one day. And those four things. Now, there's one other thing that's distinctive of Jesus' followers, and that one thing is, how do I put it? The follower of Jesus is one who places his hope in the advocacy of Jesus. What am I counting on? What am I banking on? What, as I go through my life, what is the number one most important thing that I'm putting my trust in to make my eternal well-being okay? I believe that Jesus has my back. And if I really believe that Jesus has my back, that's distinctive in the world, that only children of God who have been confronted by the truths about Jesus will actually place their hope in that. And I'm talking about Christians too. I mean, most of these things that I'm talking about are it's a counterfeit faith, it's a counterfeit Christianity, because the one thing that we're going to avoid doing is putting my life in the hands of Jesus. I don't want to do that. Tell me what I can do so that my destiny can be in my hands. You know, what law do I have to keep? What rule do I have to keep? What religious practice do I have to do? That's what the book of Galatians was all about. I mean, that's what had him so incensed in Galatians, is that you guys really don't get it, do you? Jesus died on the cross. And when he died on the cross, he was qualifying himself to be our high priest and advocate before God, and he's the one who's going to get me mercy. There's nothing you can do to ever make yourself fit for the mercy of God. Only Jesus can do that. And so count on him, bank on him, and leave your whole life in the hands of him who will be your intercessor and advocate. And that is so damned hard to do, because you feel the risk of it. What? I mean, every fiber of my being wants you to give me something so I can save myself, so that I can make this happen, and I can get eternal life because I do it right. And I've heard this my whole life, and it never stuck with me. I mean, I remember Bible teachers, probably inspired by Galatians and stuff like that, saying, it's just only Jesus. You just have to trust in Jesus. And by trusting in Jesus, that's what faith is. And I think there was something in me that said, no, come on, it just can't be that easy. And now 50 years later, it's just Jesus. It's only Jesus. You just have to put your trust in Jesus. That is what the New Testament is teaching us. So that's what's distinctive. It's an invisible kind of distinctive, interestingly, because you know, you don't wear that hope on your sleeve exactly. There's no way somebody from the outside would know that that's what I'm banking on, that's what I'm counting on. But it's going to come out in the things I say and in the way I act and the things I do. I'm not going to be judgmental and condemning of other people because I realize how broken and evil and wicked and damnable I am. And because I know how damnable I am, I can't very well blame you for being damnable just like me. We're in the same boat. And if anything, I would invite you to trust in Jesus. You know, he's the one who's going to get mercy from the Father on our behalf. So instead of being finger-wagging and condemning and self-righteous and that kind of stuff, I'm going to be merciful. And I'm going to be forgiving, and I'm going to be understanding of the sins of other people, because I understand that none of us, and not me, not you, not anybody, can ever have any standing with God on any basis that is founded on how qualified I am, or how good I am, or how righteous I am, or anything of the sort. It's because Jesus wants me. And if I believe that he will be faithful to advocate for me, then there's my hope. And I would argue that's the one distinctive of a follower of Jesus. Yeah.
I think what's interesting is somehow that message, I think, doesn't come through. I'm just reflecting on the decades of being part of this community, because I think when an accusation that I think many of us have heard is that we are a combination, I was trying to blend it, of maybe being too obsessed with orthodoxy, and then also the 2.9, the follower of the Jesus is one who pursues a life of studying the Bible. So it's just interesting, because somehow that what you just said is not what is the these things seem to have a louder volume than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm just asking you to speculate on why people might get hung up on that.
Okay, well, part of it is going to be how I will answer Ron's question. I mean, that truth is important, but it's not the bottom line. And I'll talk about that a little bit next week. So the idea, the reason that they get the idea that orthodoxy is all important is because I really do believe that truth is important. I'm not a part of this modern culture that believes that truth is kind of just, you know, whatever works for you. You know, truth is what truth is, and I need to bend to truth, not make my concept of truth bend to me. So that's going to contribute to it, I think. But just because I think it's important that we get the Bible right and that we get our faith right and understand it correctly, part of the faith that I understand is what I just articulated. That even if I don't understand it correctly, I can nevertheless be someone whose whole destiny has been placed in the hand of Jesus, and I'm counting on him to get mercy for me, and that's what makes me a child of God. That's the truth that I find when I study the Bible and try to get it right, you know. So, yeah, there's a tension there, but I think there's another part of it, and that is, knowing what I know about human beings and humanity, could it actually be that someone like me is perverting things and actually sending the message that you better be studying the Bible or you can't be saved, and you better get your doctrine right or you can't be saved? I'll bet you I do.
That's really good.
Yeah. Coming in.
Well, what you just did was an example of what I wanted to speak to. It seems like you have spent your life not just seeing the truth outside of yourself, but I think looking at yourself as someone who needs mercy. And I probably speak for a lot of people here. I really appreciate the mercy that God has given us in giving us you. Thank you.
I was thinking that's what I get for sitting up closer. I think you've kind of addressed this, but I'm going to throw it out here anyway and see what you say. I was texting a friend, Christian friend, recently, and telling her what a great response we've had at the Women's Bible Study this year, that we've had 25 to 30 women every week in our study of Romans. And her comment was, oh, that sounds like a lot of work. Why don't you all just wait till you get to heaven and let God give you all the answers then? Why are you going to all this trouble with all these Bible studies? Mm-hmm. And in light of what you've been talking about with how important it is, or is it important to get things right? Oh, I didn't know how to respond to her. I was speechless. Luckily, we were texting, because I'm not speechless very often. What would your response be to something that seemed so flippant, and yet she would consider herself a very devoted Christian?
Well, that's directly related to Ron's question and to Andrew's point. I mean, they are, right? It's right at the heart of that, is that, yeah, I mean, that's... Again, the flesh in me, the evil person in me, would like to say, well, if it's just a matter of trusting in Jesus that he's got my back and he's going to get me mercy, why bother understanding anything at all? If understanding is not something that's necessary to qualify me for receiving mercy, then why go to all the trouble? Why work that hard? Well, I mean, notice that one of the four things that I mentioned is we have a longing to know the truth if we are being sanctified by the Spirit of God. We long to know it. And if the truth is truth, and there's no options, we can't make it something other than what it is, it just is what it is. If the truth is truth, and if by the Spirit of God I'm being transformed inside and given a hunger and a longing and a yearning to know the truth, it's going to translate into me going the only place I know to go to find the truth. And I'll talk more about that. I'll probably talk about that next week. That's why my attitude toward the Bible is going to be very distinctive. As a Christian, my attitude toward the Bible is going to be very unique, because I really am going to focus on that. That is the only source of truth I know, and that's authoritative to me, and I want to know what it says. And one of the things that's alarming to me as younger generations come along, what seems to be lost in Christian culture is any kind of hunger to actually know what the Bible teaches. Just not interested. Not really. I mean, we'll use it the way our forefathers did, to proof text and quote a verse here and quote a verse there and whatever. But to actually be intent on figuring out what it does say and what it doesn't say, which is a big part of understanding the Bible as well, understanding what it says and what it doesn't say, is just part of my sanctification. It's my longing to know the truth manifesting itself in my life. And because it's truth, I'm going to want to get it right. You know, I don't want to tolerate making the places where I've misinterpreted it, misunderstood it, where I have wrong-headed ideas. I mean, God knows I've had scores of them during my lifetime, and I've had to shed them over the various decades. I got that wrong, and I got that wrong, and I started off a radically different worldview than the worldview I have now. It wasn't just a single doctrinal mistake. I had my whole worldview wrong, as do many Christians in the world today. And I never would have corrected it if I hadn't been intent on Paul, what are you saying? I mean, for me, it was Paul ended up saying something, and I felt like rebuking him. Paul, don't you know? Don't you know that it doesn't work that way? And I had to realize that, you know, either I call him an idiot or I rethink what I believe. Because obviously the Apostle Paul and I are not on the same page here. And it blew my world apart. And it caused a paradigm shift that is still, the ramifications of that are still ongoing. So I guess the bottom line is, why do we bother? Anyone who sees it as a bother, there's already something wrong in their desires. There's something missing already in their spirit. One more.
Well, I was just going to say, isn't what you're saying about truth analogous to what Paul says about goodness when he responds to the question, well, if we're going to get mercy, then why do we bother even being good?
Right.
Do we just not worry about it?
Exactly.
And the point is, no, because as a sanctified person, you want to be good. That's something you want to pursue, want to be better at. And so it seems like it's very much along the same lines. You want to know the truth because that's God working in your heart to desire those things that are valuable to him.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. Well, thank you very much. We'll finish this next week.
I love it.